Welcome to Financial Crime Matters with Kieran Beer. I'm Kieran Beer, Chief Analyst and Director of Editorial Content for ACAMS. In this episode, I talk with Jennifer Shasky-Calvary, Group Head of Financial Crime Risk at HSBC, former Financial Crimes Enforcement Network Director, and also a former federal prosecutor. Jen discusses the current challenges financial institutions face in the fight against financial crime and shares some of the lessons that she's learned in serving both the public and the private sectors. As one of the leading banks in adopting artificial intelligence tools, Jen also discusses HSBC's ongoing partnership with Google AML AI. I hope you find the podcast informative and that you'll subscribe to Financial Crime Matters, either on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud. Here we go.
How do you answer the question, who am I working with and what are the risks involved? Moody's offers holistic compliance and third-party risk management solutions so you can answer the question with confidence. Award-winning individual and entity data, workflow automation, and AI-driven solutions to manage everything from due diligence to onboarding to ongoing risk monitoring. Moody's. Understand risk and make decisions with confidence. For more information, visit moodys.com/KYC.
What's the challenge that most AML professionals face? It's balance. How do I make sure that I'm spotting as much suspicious activity as possible and avoiding a flood of false positives? The good news is that artificial intelligence is changing the game for AML teams when it comes to striking that balance. AI is enabling financial institutions to detect more crime while simultaneously reducing the number of false positives that get created. Hawk AI can help you to realize the benefits of AI. Our AML and fraud detection technology comes with a modular AI component that enables you to safely introduce explainable AI to your operation and make the improvements in effectiveness and efficiency that other FIs are making. If you'd like to know more about how Hawk can help with your transaction monitoring, customer screening, transaction screening, perpetual KYC, and transaction fraud, visit our website today at hawk.ai.
So it is a real pleasure for me today to have Jennifer Shasky-Calvary, who is the Group Head of Financial Crime Risk and Compliance at HSBC with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I've wanted to do this podcast for a long time. I'm glad that you're here. I'm afraid we're going to be eclipsed, which is a little bit of a joke.
I'm sorry.
Just to put everybody in the context of where we are, we're live from the Hollywood Conference, and there's an eclipse that has just started outside. So we are not going to be eclipsed in any other way, I can assure you. You've had a fascinating career. Talk a little bit about your time at FinCEN. It was 2012 to 2016. And it was an eventful time. There was a lot that went on. A lot of enforcement actions, a lot of money that was seized, relatively speaking, at the time. GTOs happened, and marijuana, and I don't know what you want to say about the marijuana. Marijuana was an attempt to deal with a marijuana issue that was hard to please anybody. Anyway, I've talked too long now. Tell me a little bit about when you look back on that time and what you learned and what went on.
I think you're right. It was a very interesting time to have the honor to be the director of FinCEN. And it was an honor to be there for those 4 years. I think what we had going on is we had crypto that was really just starting to come on the scene. And we issued the very first regulations related to crypto anywhere in the world. So our team were the scene setters for what's followed in terms of regulation on crypto. So that was fascinating. We had marijuana getting legalized in any number of states, as you referenced. And as it was getting legalized in the states, still illegal at a federal level, there were all these questions about, you know, what happens to the money? So if you have a business that's legal in a state, They're going to be generating money that the feds would think are criminal proceeds. What are banks to do with that? We were seeing, instead of putting money in banks, because banks wouldn't take it, they were moving it around in cash with armored cars, and that started to become quite dangerous. So trying to deal with what do you do in that situation when there's a difference between state and federal law that's quite, you know, that significant. So that was interesting. We really tried to focus our enforcement efforts away from banks and more on the other parts of the regulated industry. Yeah, there's gaming, money service businesses, even armored cars in terms of supervision because of what was going on with crypto itself. So really trying to look at the other parts of the regulated system to make sure they were becoming as mature as, in our view, banks now were. To the extent we focused on banks, we started to focus more on the smaller financial institutions. We started to see as some of the bigger banks and medium-sized banks were getting more mature compliance programs, we were seeing the illegal money move into credit unions and less regulated banks or less mature banks. So we put some focus there. So it was an interesting time, a lot going on.
And I guess it is sort of telling that to some degree the marijuana issue is still a little bit unresolved. And of course you were made fun of, or like permitting marijuana. At the same time, I think you had this idea that you wanted to be able to track the fund flows associated with it. But interesting, still goes on. It's still a little bit unresolved. So let me ask you about AMLA. Obviously the seeds of that, you know, even are during the time that you were director. But you're in this kind of unique position to talk about AMLA as someone who both was there at maybe the inception, kind of some of the germination of the idea, and then now having to implement some of that regulation. And, you know, there's things that people are really excited about and things that are lacking. So talk a little bit from both of the point of views, if you want to take one hat off and then the other.
First, in terms of the germination, you know, there's a saying, there's no new ideas in Washington, you know, kind of just new players. And I think that's right. So I wouldn't even say that many of the issues that ended up in the AML Act were even ideas or concepts that started during my time at FinCEN. Even before that, the issues have been the same for generations and decades. And a lot of good people have had good ideas over the years. But here we are now. We have the AMLA. It's taken on a lot of important issues, like the setting of priorities by the U.S. government. It's taken on this idea of a registry for beneficial ownership. Those are two of the many things that are contained in the AML Act that stand out to me. When it comes to the idea of setting national priorities, that is certainly something we were talking about back when I was the director.
Because getting the feedback from law enforcement.
Yep, getting feedback from law enforcement and getting feedback from the regulated industry is saying that, you know, we feel like we're pulled in so many directions. We want to make sure that we are providing information that's useful to law enforcement, but we need help prioritizing where we put our emphasis. And so that's kind of where the idea was born from, of like, let's give them priorities. They can prioritize, put most of their high caliber resources on the most important things, was the thought. Has that worked out in practice? Remains to be seen, right? We're still at the front end of this. I'm worried. I'm worried that if not done well, both by regulators and by industry, it could just become additive. More things that industry needs to do without upping the quality. So I think we'll only be able to judge this regulation, this legislation, when we see what the outcomes are. And the outcomes have to be more useful information to law enforcement so that they can have better outcomes in terms of arrests, seizures, preventing crime. And that's what we need to drive towards. We have to. When you prioritize something, it means you're going to do more of one thing and less of another. And we seem to just be focused on the more at the moment. We need to figure out how to have a conversation on less of the other.
Disappointing that the industry will have less. You know, originally when this was talked about, there was a thought that this would be a real tool for onboarding, and the industry is clearly going to have very restricted access to the database right now. And
moving from the priorities over to the beneficial ownership registry, and this idea, could industry use it to help with onboarding? I know several of my colleagues in industry have thought that that would be something we could use it for. I'm not sure I've ever really viewed it as realistic. Quite honestly, when I was on the FinCEN side of things, even the DOJ, Justice Department side of things, I had the pleasure of testifying on the Hill more than once on the issue of beneficial ownership. And back there then, we were talking about, should the government create a registry? And if you did, how would you verify the information in it? And once you verified it, could banks rely on it? And I think through those years of exploring those issues, I've always been of the view that verification was going to be difficult. It would probably take quite a while to get there. And if you didn't verify, then banks weren't going to be able to rely on it. That being said, I'm still a fan of the direction the U.S. government is going in because of the experience I've had with the U.K., the United Kingdom's system. They
Companies
do
House Registry.
Companies House Registry, right? And again, it's one where you don't have a verification procedure. But now being at a bank in charge of a compliance program, we do use the information from Companies House as a piece of information that helps us in our detection of financial crime, and it does help us. I think even without verification, I have high hopes that it'll take
a start. Something, right?
Exactly.
Let me just ask you a little bit about global regulation and dealing with that in a financial institution that has to thread many regulatory needles, I guess, is the image I'm going to come up with. You obviously now have a lot of experience with EU and Asia and thoughts about the course of that. Are things getting better in terms of regulation when you look globally or what?
Yeah, so maybe just for a moment, just to give the audience a sense of who HSBC is or where we're located to answer this question. So we're in more than 60 jurisdictions globally, in several countries in Asia, as you mentioned, several in Europe. We're headquartered in the UK, but we consider Hong Kong a second headquarters. We're big in the Middle East. We're big in Mexico and have a presence in other parts of Latin America and in the U.S. We're one of the largest U.S. dollar clearers globally. So that's kind of who we are and where we are. That means we deal with a lot of regulators. You know, there's no simple answer to what's going on with regulators, or each one's different. And they're at different stages of perhaps their own maturity, their own development, their own unique experiences of what's important in any given country. What I can say, though, is we do see them working more and more together and sharing best practices and experiences with one another, which I think is healthy and good for the overall system. We need to see more uniformity in the way they treat issues wherever possible, understanding not each country is going to agree on their policy outcomes, but when they have highly differentiated systems, it becomes very hard to manage that because money does move cross-border and it creates complexity for financial institutions to be able to manage. But it's one of the nice things about being at a global financial institution like ours is we do get to see the best practices in different jurisdictions in terms of regulators. Yeah. And we learn from them. We try to take those practices and at least use them inside our own institution globally. And when asked, we share with other regulators, and we're often asked, what do you see out there that we could learn from? And we try to share, you know, those learnings as well.
This is a question I ask frequently, and it's based on probably my own anxiety as well, some things that I'm seeing in the world. And that is, you know, we were moving kind of fairly quickly towards a global consensus about compliance and anti-money laundering. And there's a possibility, when I look around, there's at least places here and there where there's a pushback on privacy issues. There's a pushback because of some global tensions. Are we moving forward enough? Is that a real perception that it's slowed, or how would you characterize it?
I do think the geopolitical situation is more complex, you know, these days than it was even 5 years ago. There's a lot less uniformity in views, and some of that is directly in the financial crime space. To be candid, you know, some of it is as a result of sanctions. Sanctions are a policy tool, particularly when used unilaterally by a country. It's one thing if you have UN consensus or something like that. Not a lot of UN consensus on anything these days. So you see more use of unilateral sanctions, or maybe like in the case of Russia, you see US, UK, EU, Australia perhaps working in alignment, but other parts of the world not agreeing with the direction that's going in. And so there's disagreement in various parts of the world on those policy objectives in these sanctions, and a recognition that some of the tools used in the anti-money laundering area dovetail with the sanctions authorities. And so I think the disagreement geopolitically over the policy outcomes of sanctions is bleeding over into having an impact on AML as well. Whereas if you didn't have the sanctions and just focused on the, you know, anti-drugs, you know, anti-human trafficking kind of agendas, there's a lot more consensus.
Moving from the public sector into the private sector, what did you bring that helped you create an FIU within HSBC? What does the private sector have to teach the public sector and vice versa?
First of all, I don't want to take credit for setting up the FIU at HSBC. It was there when I arrived, established by actually one of my former government colleagues, Mark Fungard, who's now at Stripe. So he had helped to create that for HSBC. You know, what are some of the ideas or thoughts I brought with me from government into HSBC that feature now as a part of our program? I think one of them was really the focus on culture and tone from the top, the idea of just how important that is. When I was at the Department of Justice trying to make decisions on whether or not there should be cases against financial institutions, criminal cases against financial institutions for failing to have effective anti-money laundering programs, one of the things that was always in the back of my head when I was looking at an institution was, do I think they have the right culture and they actually care about ensuring that their products and services aren't being exploited for crime? Or do I think they actually don't care at all, or worse yet, are actively trying to facilitate crime? And depending on where you are on that spectrum, there's a different enforcement response, or perhaps a supervision response versus an enforcement response versus a criminal enforcement. You know, there's a bit, I think, as I went to HSBC, about recognizing the importance of that relationship with your regulators, with your law enforcement in the various countries where you're operating, showing them that you actually care about the policy agenda that they care about. We don't want our products and services to be used for financial crime, and we need to convince them in everything we do every day that that's who we are as an institution. And so whether that is being at a conference like this and trying to share best practices, whether that's engaging in public-private partnership on things that are important to law enforcement and with helping them with high-priority cases, you know, anything we can do to show that we're want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem, I think is important for an institution to do, and certainly has been important to us.
And anything that you think, now that you're on the private side, that the private sector can teach government that maybe government doesn't understand?
Yeah, I think it's mostly the practicalities of trying to implement the policy objectives they have. So I think where I see it go poorly is where regulators in various countries try to be too prescriptive on the exact solution and what a financial institution should do to meet a policy objective. It works much better when regulators come to the industry and say, here's the policy objective we're trying to achieve. Help us craft something that makes sense and would actually work in the financial industry. You'd be able to implement it. It would be effective. I think we need more joining together on the solutions for more flexibility BSAG, given to financial institutions.
But there's these more. You could do more.
BSAG can do some of that. When it's operating at its best, it does. You know, I think there's BSAG, quite frankly, over the years, waxes and wanes in terms of how effective it is at doing those. And it's not just the U.S. Other countries need to be doing the same thing. I actually often brag to other countries about BSAG, the concept of BSAG, and what it's meant to achieve, and suggest to other regulators that if they don't have something similar, that they should set it up, because it can be such a force for good.
Let me go on to talking about technology. I think you've been a real innovator and user of technology, and most recently AI. So I think, you know, in our world, a lot of people are, we went through a period where there was some AI hype, even though there was something to it.
Now AI seems to be coming on renewed in terms of the repute it has, the expectations we have for it. But you've entered into a big project with Google and you're using a lot of AI. And how can you frame talking about that in a way that too that people will like say, oh, I could do that or I couldn't do that or whatever?
I think our journey with artificial intelligence and particularly machine learning started probably 5 years ago when we were in the midst of a deferred prosecution agreement. We were needing to upgrade our AML transaction monitoring system. We were deemed not to even be as good as kind of the mainstream financial institutions of our size and scale at doing rules-based transaction monitoring, what everyone on the street was doing at the time. We were deemed kind of below where we needed to be. So we were working very hard to upgrade that, to bring it up to the level of the street. And I think as we were doing that, we were looking at it and going, you know, this actually isn't a very effective way to detect financial crime. So even if we get it as good as everyone else on the street, and everybody's been using this technique now for over a decade, it's still not going to be where we think we should be. And so we started on a project in parallel to also try to envision what could the next generation of transaction monitoring look like. If we got to start over with a whiteboard and try to detect financial crime, how would we do it? And that's what ultimately led us into a partnership with Google and the use of machine learning. And so in this project, we scrapped rules-based transaction monitoring and started over. So it's not about simply making today's system of rules-based transaction monitoring more efficient. It was a new way of detecting financial crime. And so we went on that journey. We co-developed the product that Google now has out for sale, AML AI by Google. And we have it operating over 80% of our customers and their transactions at this point. So we've had it in operation in the UK for, I think, at least a couple years now. And what we've found is we're finding more financial crime. We're finding it faster, we're providing more useful information to law enforcement, and we're doing it with less unnecessary friction for our good customers, those who are not engaged in financial crime. So we have certainly proved to ourselves it's not just hype, it's not just a theory. In practice, it is demonstrably better than rules-based TM.
Talk about rules-based and the system using AI that you cleared the board. Is there an example of how it operates differently that people can grasp?
With rules-based transaction monitoring, you might say something like, look for large round dollar amounts, you know, at this threshold setting, and then generate an alert. They're very blunt questions that end up taking in a large amount of your legitimate traffic, which then means that you're either hiring many people to clear those alerts, and most of what they're doing is just clearing noise away, or you're trying to use another system on the back end to now risk rate the alerts that have been generated and give you the ones that you should be looking at. It's not actually the best way to find financial crime, this idea of looking one transaction at a time to see if the transaction's suspicious. If I go back to my old crime fighting days, we didn't investigate transactions. We investigated people and companies. And we, as financial institutions, turns out we have people and companies as customers. So we can actually be looking at our customers. So the way this is different, the way that our approach is different, is we're actually looking at our customer, all of everything we know about them in context, as well as their transactions. And then we're giving them basically a score, a financial crime score, like a credit score. What is the probability that this customer is engaged in financial crime today? And if it's a high probability, then you're gonna go off for investigations. And we do that by looking at our customers and their network, who is everyone that they're interacting with, and looking at who's in their network. We do that by looking at previous cases where we had identified financial crime, and then training the machine to look for other things that look just like that. Letting the machine learning give the weight to the data attributes that would most help it to find other financial crime instances like the ones we've already found.
And am I right in thinking that this kind of AI is particularly beneficial for HSBC, which has just vast amounts of data from all over the world, and it's still like figuring out how that works for smaller institutions. Maybe there's going to be a point at which information is shared, but somehow anonymized. Is that a fair thing? That it helps that you're so big, or am I not understanding AI?
I think it did, certainly in the research and development phase. I think that was one of the reasons why we wanted to partner with a partner like Google, is because once we developed some of the insight that helped us to come up with what the model should look like, we thought that that model might be good for other financial institutions straight out of the box, right? Like, we've already done the work, so sell it, share it to other institutions. You still train it on your own data, but the thinking of how you get to that model has already been done. So that was the partnership with Google. And we actually tested that idea internally. So we started this first time we went out with the new system. We did it in our UK market. And we had trained it all on UK data and our UK typologies and everything else. So we asked ourselves, what if we just took that model and just put it in another market? Would it be better than rules-based TM? Or do we have to make a specific model, different model for each country and each market? And so we did a test and we just put it in, and it turned out straight out of the box, it was better than rules-based TM, which is why we think that there's legs to this idea of it being able to be used by other financial institutions. And Google will make it better, at least this is the theory. They're meant to be making it better because they will be working with different financial institutions and hopefully making the model better over time. And we'll be consumers of that as well. So we may have started the movement, but we hope to benefit from others' learnings as well.
Well, I think it's obvious to say you are a thought leader. You know, you have been out in front so much in the whole anti-financial crime area, both in the private and the public sector. And so we're running out of time. And I guess that leads me to one of those questions. Where are we going? What are your hopes? What are your fears in terms of the future of the fight against financial crime?
My real hope is that we finally crack this code around how do we work together, public and private sector, to help financial institutions figure out where to prioritize their resources. I do see a light at the end of the tunnel here. We have that, and I don't think it's just an oncoming train. We have the AMLA, which I think is a step forward. The Wolfsburg Group just put out new principles for how a third line of defense and audit could examine financial institutions for effectiveness. I actually think that that might be a step between AMLA and how supervisors might supervise financial institutions for effectiveness. This idea of how do we prioritize, how do we come to agreement that enables financial institutions to prioritize to get law enforcement what they most want and keep the financial system safe. The cracking of that code is the most difficult thing that I think we've been working on for the last decade, quite frankly. But I'm starting to see some green shoots of we might be able to get there. So keep our fingers crossed.
We'll keep our fingers crossed. And I will just say thank you, Jen Chasky, for doing the podcast. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Karen.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Jennifer Chasky Calvary. I hope you found the podcast compelling and that you'll subscribe to Financial Crime Matters on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud so that you'll get an alert for each new podcast. Because financial crime matters to me and to you. See you next time.